Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me this week is Dave Platt, president of Rolling Thunder Computing. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Always a pleasure to be here. Always a pleasure to be talking to my friends at Cyrix again. It is an honor to be able to spout here.
On a potentially historic election day.
Yes, indeed. Although, I don't know, they say they're all historic. Which elections have you ever been to that was not, say, oh, the most important one of our time? Yeah, since the last one and until the next one. So,
Fair enough. Well, let's start off with some history. I understand you got interested in computers playing Star Trek on an old digital equipment system.
Yes, it was a DEC PDP-10 back at Colgate University the fall of my freshman year. And you could play Star Trek. You could press number 5 to fire photon phasers or rear photon torpedoes. I can't quite remember, but you would type in numbers and fire the phasers or the photon torpedoes. You could head toward the enemy at warp speed or away. And wow, that was just the coolest thing in the universe. And that inspired me. And I just started hanging around the computer center. And then I wanted to write a better game. I wanted to add some features to the game and stuff like that. And one thing led to another, and here I am. Go figure.
I think you played some Colossal Cave back in the day, too, right?
Colossal Cave, that was brilliant. That was the first text-based adventure game. And it wasn't just numbers that you picked off a list. You had to come up with words and type in the words. The text would say, you're in front of a locked door. And you would type in, unlock. And they'd say, with what? And you were carrying a key. Oh, with key. And the door is now open. You type in walk through the door. That was the text-based adventure game. Eventually, it grew into Zork and all the other ones from Infocom. I was working for a company once that shared the office floor with them a long time ago, and I always enjoyed their text-based adventure games. I remember they would advertise, we have the most sophisticated peripheral ever, and we engage the best peripheral of all time, and there was a picture of the human brain. And they were trying to say that, oh yes, it's reading the text and thinking about this, the imagination. And of course, you don't see that now. It's got to be graphics, it's got to be music, et cetera, et cetera. That's what it was back in the day. What can I say?
And then I think when you were in grad school at Dartmouth, you finally got your fingers on keyboard a lot with a computer account there.
Yeah, Dartmouth was a big deal there. John Kemeny, designer of the BASIC language, and his coworker Thomas Kurtz in the math department. And they had come up with the BASIC language. And they had this idea that everybody in the Dartmouth community should use computers. And this at the time was cataclysmic. Back at Colgate, to get a computer account, you had to go, you had to register, you had to ask nicely, you had to convince them that you needed to do your work. It was rationed, you know, sort of held back for the elect, if you will. And at Dartmouth, it was intended to be a general purpose utility for all students. So you showed up and the student ID number on your ID card was your login ID and your birth date was your password to start with. You were supposed to change it. Nobody ever did. Users are lazy then and now and won't pay any attention to their security then or now. And there were things that you could do online. For example, if you were looking for housing, there was a housing program that you could run and type in, you know, did you need to be within walking distance or how much were you to pay, and it would show you the different things that were available. And so civilians would use computers for ordinary run-of-the-mill stuff. It wasn't just for programmers. The idea was everybody could be a programmer. The idea was that there would be users, and the users would run the programs that the programmers would write, and they would accomplish useful work this way. And that was the first place I ever ran into that. It was quite a change in the thoughts from the way it had previously been.
I think you said they had like an ancient Craigslist for rentals in the area and rides.
Yeah, that's what it was. That was the basic idea. It had roughly the same graphics as Craigslist has today, which is none whatsoever. It was just lists of text. And you could type in how far you were willing to drive and how much you were willing to pay. And they would show the lists of things that had them. And then you had to print them out or write down the phone number and go call them on a telephone as opposed to emailing them because there was mail on campus, but it really hadn't gotten out into the civilian community. But that was kind of the first one. And of course, housing was always in short supply and it was kind of expensive and it didn't really solve that problem. But at the very least, you now had a way of getting things done. And it was like an early Craigslist. And whenever anybody says to me that, oh, yes, you got to have fancy graphics to get anything done. Oh, you got to have dancing Tinkerbells and color fades and stuff like this to make any money in the computing world, I'd say, yeah, sorry. One word, Craigslist. Look at that. They've got just plain lines of text, nothing else. And what did they do? Well, by taking over the classified ad market, they single-handedly kicked one leg out from underneath the newspaper industry, brought it down almost single-handedly. They don't have any text then or now, but they have the content. They have useful content that accomplishes useful work easily at a price people are willing to pay, and they've been fantastically successful. The rest of the design in the computing industry should take a real look for that, which is if you get the content right, the decoration is not a huge deal.
So speaking of getting the content right, I think it was pretty early on that you moved from just building things to trying to figure out usability and how do I build better systems for people?
Very much so. Sort of the first systems I built, oh, there was a chaff decoy launcher for a warship, and there was an ion implantation machine, and there was a touchscreen dealing system for foreign exchange traders. And I fairly quickly came to see that it was not programming this or programming that was going to make it successful. More or less anything you could think of, you could program. It was more of a question of what ought to be programmed to help the users accomplish what they need to do. And I started off, as all geeks do, by making things complicated so that you could do every last little thing that you could think of you were able to do. Complex things were possible, but because complex things had been made possible, simple things were not simple. And I found that, for example, in the foreign exchange dealing system, you could configure the data feeds that you wanted to see. You could cut a piece of Reuters and put it over here and cut a piece of Telerate and put it over there. But nobody wanted to do that. They wanted to use data pages that somebody else had configured, and they just wanted to look at them and think about their financial dealing. And looking at them and having it made clear what was what and what you were looking at and when it was good and when it was bad, that was far more important than being able to cut and paste and move them around yourself. And so I learned very early on, I mean, it took some years to get it through my head, but the difference between the people that program the systems and the users that use it. Now, 30 years ago, just about every user was a programmer themselves, but today that is not the case. And in my book, Why Software Sucks, I talk about that. That is Platt's first, last, and only law of user experience design, which is know thy user, for he is not thee. Your user is not you. Your user is not you. Okay? As I tell these guys, look, your users are doctors, they're retail clerks, they're airline pilots, they're airline passengers, they're foreign exchange traders. You, on the other hand, are a burned-out computer geek. And what makes you happy and what you like to have is not what your users like to have. Classic example, when I teach at Microsoft or somewhere like that, I say, how many of you guys drive a car with a manual transmission, clutch and a stick shift? Let me see the hands. And I get about half of the hands. I say, okay, now how many more would if your wives would let you? Or if they came on minivans, did you need to drive because you're becoming a cranky old Ford? And I get about half the remaining hands. So 3/4 of programmer geeks, 6 out of 8, think that something that's harder to learn initially and then more work to use all day, every day, but gives you better control. 6 out of 8 programmers think that that's a good trade-off. I say, okay, now what percentage of cars do you think are sold in the U.S. with stick shifts? And at the time, they say, oh, I bet it's low, 30%. Ha, you wish. At the time, it was about 12 to 14%. And it's gone down a lot since then. It's very hard to find a car with a stick shift anymore.
Even a supercar.
Yes, indeed. So 6 out of 8 programmer geeks think that something that's harder to learn initially and then more work to use all day, every day, but gives you better control. 6 out of 8 of you geeks think that's a good trade-off. Only 12.5%, 1 out of 8 of the general populace, thinks that's a good trade-off. And in fact, it's even less than that, okay? Because all 6 of you geeks are in that 1 out of 8. Right? Normal people don't drive stick shifts. Why do they not drive stick shifts? Because the control that a stick shift gives them is not something they care about. They don't want to drive somewhere. They want to be somewhere. If they could magically click their heels 3 times, 1, 2, 3, and magically, bam, snap, be at the New Hampshire State Liquor Store, they would. And so they are not interested in the process. They are interested in the result. They could take a transporter there, they would. So your user is not you. You value control. Your user values ease of use. You don't want to know how long it took me to get that through my head.
You've more recently got a bee in your bonnet trying to help out your dad in his new living accommodations.
This was fascinating. My parents are getting older, and my dad just turned 86, as a matter of fact. And to see them struggling with modern tech was very frustrating. For example, my dad has a MacBook that he can sort of use, and he has an iPad that he can read the New York Times on his iPad. He's okay with that. But to see him do things like he wants to watch a movie, he wants to rent a movie on Amazon, he wants to watch it on his big screen TV, that is just so extremely difficult. The smart screen TV is incredible. They show you a keyboard, and you've got to move the cursor around with the button controls on your TV remote. Okay, you have to beat, deet, 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 deet to move to the next letter. It wanted to put one letter in. If one of my Harvard students did that, I would flunk his sorry ass so fast he would change his major to Sanskrit. Okay, that is just not an okay thing to do. Well, I bought an HDMI cable. I hooked it up to his TV, so what he was doing on his MacBook would show up on his TV. But even that was very hard. Just the idea. When people get older, it is just very hard for them to learn new things. I wish it were otherwise. I'd be lying if I said I was looking forward to that myself. Just saying, oh, well, here, this is the remote control for your TV. Oh, but this is the remote control for my TV. Oh, yeah, well, it's the remote control for your cable box. But I use that for my TV. No, you got to use this one for your TV. You got to press the input key. The input, what the hell? And things that to us are extremely simple, to them are new and not intuitive, and they saturate fairly quickly. More than two or three things, they just say, okay, to heck with it, this is not for me. And trying to help them do these things that to us are ordinary and to them are just not possible led me to the thought that apps really need to be designed for seniors to use, to make them very easy for seniors to use, because that's just where their heads were at. And I wish that could be changed, but it can't. And it is not my parents' job to adjust to the software. On the other hand, I maintain that it is our software's job to adjust itself to our users. Hey, what a concept. Remember years ago, we were all going to have to become computer literate? Oh yes, we need to be computer literate, right? You have to learn about saving files. Yeah, that's part of being computer literate. You have to save your file. Well, you know, Alan Cooper likes to say that a person who is computer literate has been hurt so often that the scar tissue is so thick that they no longer feel the pain. That's what computer literacy is. And the breakthrough came when my dad and mom were having to move out of their independent apartment into assisted living. They're in one of these continuing care retirement communities where you do that when you get older. And so my dad loves music, but he had to leave all of his CDs behind. There wasn't a place to put them, and he can't really read the letters on them anymore. It's very thin, and it's hard for him with his arthritis to open the box. It's hard for him to take the disc out and put it on. It's hard for him to take it out and put it back in the box and put the backs on the screen. If he drops it on the floor, which is easy to do, it's hard for him to pick it up. And just this whole CD thing was just not working anymore. All right. It happens. And said to myself, oh, well, hey, piece of cake. Look, we've got Spotify. $10 a month. Heck, I'll put you on my membership. It won't cost anything. And then you can access far more music than you could have on your CD rack. You can have damn near anything, you know, just a snap of a finger. But the Spotify user interface is essentially impossible for him to use. The Spotify app that goes on your desktop, it's just not something you can use. It is just way too complicated. Spotify thinks that this is flexible and useful and makes their users happy. Oh, you can do this, you can do that, you can do that, you can do this. You can make a playlist, you can play a radio station, you can have recommendations, you can see the discography, you can have streams made for you, this, that, and the other. Fine, for their 20-year-old users and even maybe their 50-year-old users. But their 80-year-old users, no, they just can't do it. So what I did is I thought about this for a second, and what I did is I bought a smart speaker, a Bose SoundTouch speaker, which knows on its own how to access Spotify. There's a button on top. You press button number one, and it plays a stream that you configure on Spotify. Let's press button number two, and it plays a different stream from Spotify. All right. But it was very hard. He couldn't see the buttons. They were too small for him to press. The tiny little pictures for volume up and volume down, they were too small for him to see. If you look at them next to a quarter, the little speaker says the volume up is approximately the size of George Washington's ear on a U.S. quarter. An 86-year-old cannot see that, and then is wrong to ask him to. So what I did is I sat down with Xamarin. Turns out that the speaker, the smart speaker, exposes a web server, a RESTful interface, and you can send it commands. You could say through a program, say, hey, speaker, play button number one. Instead of pressing the button on the top of the speaker, another computer can, over Wi-Fi, say, hey, yo, smart speaker, play button number one. And that's what I did. I wrote an app that runs on his iPad. I used a Microsoft Xamarin product that I've used a few times. I taught it at Harvard a few times. I really like it. Cover one C# code base and cover both iOS and also Android from the same code base. And so I just made a really, really simple app. It had power on button and volume up and down that looked just like his TV remote control. So he knew exactly what they were. And then there were just four other buttons. One said classical, one said jazz, one said American songbook, and one said call Dave. And so all he does is he brings up that program, and he can still do that on his iPad. He still reads his New York Times on it. There are four buttons. He taps the one for the music he wants to hear right now, and it plays over a smart speaker. Now, some people would call it less powerful. I would not accept that term. Power is the rate at which work is done, and if you gave him the regular Spotify thing, he couldn't do a damn thing no matter how long he sat there. So the power of that to him would be zero. More flexible, yeah, but that is not something that he is able to use. He just picks it up, taps the icon to launch my app. He presses button number 1, 2, 3, and 4, and out comes the music that that's programmed to do.
Now, what is button number 4 for? What does it mean to call Dave?
Button number 4 was different. The other three are Spotify radio stations that I set up, but this one goes to a Spotify playlist on his account. And what I can do right here in my office, I can bring up the Spotify app, which I can use. I can log in on his account because I gave it to him. I know what the credentials are. And that button number four plays a playlist, the button four playlist on that account. And he can ask me for anything that he wants, and I can put it on his playlist. And it only takes about 30 seconds. He says, hey, Dave, can I hear such and such? And I say, yeah, here. Bang, there you go. Tap button number four, and it'll play the thing that you asked for. You know, the week after my mother died back in May, he said, you know, Dave, I'd really love to hear Paint Your Wagon. I think that was the first show your mom and I ever saw. Could you put Paint Your Wagon on my speaker for me, please? I said, sure, Dad. I'm happy to do that. Put it on. And he called me back in the afternoon. I thought he was going to say, thank you. That was such a great thing. And says, oh, sorry, not to complain or anything. But you know what? That was the film soundtrack. You think you'd find me the original Broadway cast, please? All right, fine, wise guy. You know, and he then had what he wanted. But what I was discovering through this, I hadn't really thought of this when I was programming it, was that it's not just the music that he gets. And this button four playlist, I hadn't really thought of this. But it is a connection that he has to me, to anybody else, because now he calls me up and said, hey, can you give me this kind of music? And so we're talking about things. And I say, yeah, I can do that. And he says, well, I would like to hear South Pacific with one particular star. There were several versions in this one. So-and-so was the lead. I can't remember who. Get the one with this person as the lead, would you? And I looked in. Yeah, there were two or three different ones. And he said, you know, I heard that guy once. He was singing another, and he got to tell me all about it, and I got to ask him all about it. So it's not just the music. It is the personal connection. It is not being abandoned inside an assisted living unit that is all locked down for COVID. They won't even let me in to visit them. And it is caring and being cared for. It is a small antidote to the isolation that COVID is enforcing on all of us. And it's from just one little thing, a connection to a playlist. I really had not thought of that in advance until I did it. And then I say, holy Toledo, wow, that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, I've seen the user interface that Dave came up with, and it is elegant and brutal in its simplicity. It's just four big, giant buttons, 1, 2, 3, and 4, a giant power button like the size of an apple.
Well, his eyesight is the way it is. Yeah. I wish it was better, but what he has is what he has. He shouldn't have to get his glasses to use my program, and he doesn't because I've made it that way. But it's not even the physical thing so much. I mean, obviously that is necessary, but it's not sufficient. It is the cognitive load, as you were saying. It is brutal in its simplicity. That works. That works for him. And he does not miss being able to make his own playlist. I'm not sure he even understands that he can make his own playlist. And if he did, I'm not sure he would give a damn. So, you know, he grew up with LP albums and then CDs. And the notion of mixing and matching songs is just not something that he's ever done. And I've been working on other apps like this. If you look at assistedcomputing.org, that is my new website for this. I call it the Assisted Computing Movement, sort of like assisted living, which is the kind of place where he's living right now. And the idea is to make these ultra, ultra simple applications for seniors. Things like people are taking part in many, many Zoom meetings now. In fact, just now, my father was saying last week that, boy, Veterans Day is coming up. He's a Vietnam veteran. He was a surgeon in Vietnam in 1967, if memory serves, with the 101st Airborne Division. Screaming Eagles, and says, gosh, other years here at my retirement community, I would sit down with the other vets and we'd drink beer and we'd swap lies and we'd say, hey, where did you serve? And tell war stories. And gosh, I sure wish I could do that again, but we can't. We're locked down. We can't get together. And I thought about it a while. And I went to the activities director and said, yo, hey, Liz, my dad is asking for this and it'd be a great thing to have. How about a Zoom conference of the veterans here at Riverwoods? And they could get together on the Zoom. And they could talk to each other, and they could drink their own beer sitting in their own rooms. I mean, it's not the best. Of course, being in person would be better, but that is not what is possible today. But hey, you know, if we put them all on Zoom, we could do this. And she's, yeah, you know, hey, that's a great idea. We'll do that. Keeping track of the Zoom links gets tricky. You get an email, here's the Zoom link for this one. You get another email, here's the Zoom link for his sister, who lives in California, has got a Zoom thing that her family gets on once in a while, and stuff like that. And it's hard for him to keep track of the emails to figure out which link is in which email. So that cognitive difficulty is hard for him now. You and I would just use the search capability in our inbox, but it's hard for him and he shouldn't have to. So what I wrote is a Zoom launcher. You set it up with 5 Zoom links and it shows buttons. Veterans Day Riverwoods. There's a big button on it and you click that and it launches Zoom. And there's another one, your sister, Soretta. And he clicks on that and it launches her Zoom meeting if there's anybody on it. And I put that program on his desktop. And I can configure it. He doesn't have to set it up. That's the key. He doesn't have to set it up. He can't set it up. Instead, the activities director sends it to me, the email, and I go and use the configured page. It's very, very, very easy. And I go set it up, and hey, now he's got a new button on his panel that says Riverwoods Veteran Zoom, and he clicks on that, bam, and he's in. So I do a relatively small amount of work, and he does exactly zero work. And that's a good trade-off. Another one that I'm working on, I'm trying to use the same idea for music to deal with his TV remote control. Go look at your own main cable box TV remote control. Can any one of you, anybody listening to me, can you use 10% of the stuff that's there? If you can, I congratulate you. My teenager cannot do that. And that tells you the situation is desperate. Why they built a piece of crap like that, I don't quite know. There will be a lot of Sanskrit majors at Harvard by the time I'm finished. But if you think about it, what does my dad do? Does he set his DVR? He does not set his DVR. He doesn't know he has a DVR. And if he did, he wouldn't care. Does he buy their preset movies? Not usually. Does he scan up and down 500 channels? That's pretty rare. What does he do? Well, he goes to the channel numbers that he can remember. He types in 44, enter, and bam, there's a channel on TV, and maybe he watches it. Problem is, channel 44 is CNN, and that is not something that leads to a peaceful sleep at nights. It just isn't. So I thought, just like I put his favorite music on an iPad app, I would put his favorite TV channels on an iPad app. And the brutal simplicity that you described with four buttons for four different kinds of music, I would have four or maybe a few more, maybe 10, perhaps, of his favorite TV channels. Here's WGBH. Here's ESPN2. Here's ESPN Classic. Good games that have already been played. Stuff like that. There's three or four others that he watches. And I would put them there and he would just tap that one and bam, his TV would come up and show it. And I show that to people and say, damn, Senior Schmieder, I want one of those. Where can I get it? I'm working on it, okay?
I did kind of a voice-based version of that because like you said, like even for younger users, turning on the TV, changing the input, turning on the stereo,
absolutely,
getting it all working. I tied it all together with a Harmony universal remote and then wrapped that in Alexa so you can just say entertainment and boom. It all turns on. And I got the fireplace to fire up and the lights to dim as well.
Oh, now that's cool.
To find my next job, first, I want to hear about dozens of jobs I am overqualified for.
Someday, I will talk to a recruiter who knows the difference between Java and JavaScript. That will be the one.
Would I mind commuting 3 hours each way each day? Of course not.
All I have to do is go through 5 separate interviews, complete a 10-hour coding exercise, and recite the national anthem backwards? I'm in.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
A Harmony remote, I looked at that, and the problem is they did not have an external API, and that would have been a really handy thing. I had to find a remote IR emitter box that would accept Wi-Fi commands and then emit IR codes that go to the cable box. They built Wi-Fi into TVs and then provided an open API, then I could just tap right in with these ultra-simple things. That's kind of what I'm hoping to do with assisted computing, is show these demonstrations and try and convince manufacturers and software companies that, you know what, this is a huge, huge, huge market, providing easier apps for people that want easier apps, that to say, hey, there is a market for simple and easy, and they've got money, and they're not averse to spending it, and you're chasing the teenagers, and you're missing a business opportunity here, guys. So assistedcomputing, all one word, .org is where you'll find it. Assistedcomputing.com was squatting on it, wanted $5,000, so I said, hell with it. And I snagged assistedcomputing.org for $20.
Nice. Yeah, I've looked through assistedcomputing.org, and it made me wish I had been able to implement a couple things when my grandmother was still alive. One, I think that they have now is basically a remote picture frame that you can update the slideshow to and put new pictures in. I wish I could have done that.
You know what? We just bought him one of those for his birthday, you know, 2 weeks ago. And he is absolutely ecstatic with it. I am absolutely astounded. There are a number of different ones I looked around, and the very best resolution was this company called Aura, A-U-R-A, like Aurora without the roar. And it was a little more expensive than the others. It had better resolution. And they are ultra, ultra simple for the owner of the frame to use. We give it to him. We plugged it in. I went up and I configured it sitting outside in the parking lot where I could get to his Wi-Fi because they won't let me in the building. Put it onto his Wi-Fi, no problem. And then using the configuration app of the frame, you can set up a Google folder. And whatever photos you drag to the Google folder will magically show up on the frame. And when you take photos out of the Google folder, they will magically disappear from the frame. So all we have to do is take our photos and put them in the Google folder, and they show up on his frame. And he doesn't have to do anything at all with it. I get to set the stepping frequency anywhere from 30 seconds to 4 hours. Right now, I have it set on 15 minutes. He's pretty happy with that one, actually. And there's only one feature there that he uses, and that is you hold up the frame like this, and you imagine that you're holding your phone in landscape orientation. For example, put your finger on the top, and you slide it to the right, and there's a little sensor, and that moves to the next picture. Or you put your finger on the top, and you slide it to the left, and you go to the previous picture. And that he was able to grok. I say, okay, Dad, see the frame? Yeah. You want to put your finger on the top? Yeah. Slide your finger to the right. Oh, look at that. It moved. Okay. Put your finger on the top. Yeah. Okay. Slide it to the left. Oh, look, it moved. And that is, I won't use the term intuitive, because intuitive means that something that's built into your psyche, like salmon homing up rivers, and humans don't have any of that. But something that is familiar, that allows you to easily, where the action that takes place, moving something, is already set in your brain in connection with the gesture that you're having. So it is a very, very familiar thing to him. And bam, he picked it up like that. I was astonished. And he loves it because he sees all the family. He loves to see that. We rented a house on the lake for this coming summer and where we've gone before. And he so misses the lake. And we said, oh, we're going to take you to the lake. Oh, you reserve the lake? Oh, yeah, we're going to reserve the lake. And we put pictures of the lake from the previous summers. And now he sees the photos of the lake going by and it gives him something to look forward to. For Veterans Day, it has a number of photos of him in Vietnam. There he is driving a Jeep. And the villagers brought in an elephant once that had been shot. And he saved the elephant. And it was the village's work elephant. And he brought the elephant back from death's door. So there's a picture of him with the elephant. And he loves to see that. And more than that, it is a conversation piece. When the staff comes to bring his trays or do his laundry or just sit and talk with him, he says, hey, look at this. There's a picture of whatever. And he talks to them about it. It starts conversations. It breaks the loneliness. It facilitates discussions. And it's not just a psychological depression kind of thing. Your brain actually rots faster if you don't have this kind of stuff. And so it is very helpful in a, not just a mental, but also a physical health kind of sense. And so if anybody is looking at that, I do not gain anything at all from these guys. I don't have any stock in them or anything at all. I am really, really happy with my Aura picture frame.
Cool. Now, I understand you're trying to raise the next generation of UI and UX experts teaching at Harvard.
Oh, yes. Well, two things. First of all, I teach at Harvard University Extension School and also their summer session. And I teach Introduction to User Experience and I teach Advanced User Experience there. And we work on term projects there. I am creating in my own geeky image, you know? I teach them to know that user is not thee. I teach them that it is all in understanding who the user is and where they're coming from and what problem are they trying to solve, what pleasurable state are they trying to enter, and what would they consider to be the characteristics of a good solution. I teach them what I think they ought to know. I teach them that the appearance doesn't matter. Too many people get up and say, oh, should we have a fade? How about a curtain? You know, should we have a little color gradient here? And say, no. That comes at the end. In the beginning, you got to look at who the user is and what problem they're trying to solve and get the basic interaction flow working. Then and only then, at the end, do you decorate it. Yes, things ought to be decorated well rather than poorly. But that is the very last thing. And in fact, coding is the next to last thing. It all comes down to understanding who the user is and what problem they're trying to solve. And a lot of times you don't know this. A story from my father years and years ago. He just graduated from medical school. Very first job right out of medical school. You know, they graduated in May and July 1st, the new guys. They were called interns at the time. And there he was, July 1st. I guess it was 1964, it must have been. And there he is, brand new MD degree on the wall, the ink's not even dry. Patient comes in complaining he hadn't had a bowel movement in a week. And my dad says, all right, well, that's cool. Yeah, bowel movement, 4 years of medical school, bowel movement, I can do a bowel movement, fine. Gives him a laxative, nothing happens. Gives him a stronger laxative, not a thing. Tries an enema, nothing comes out. Does an x-ray, can't see a thing. Does an ultrasound, it's unremarkable. Finally, he takes him up to the operating room and does an exploratory laparotomy, opens up his belly, looks inside, nothing. Perfectly normal abdomen. Finally, he does what he should have done in the beginning, which is take a thorough history. In the course of which, he asks this patient, what do you do for a living? Guy says, I'm a musician. Finally, the light goes on. Ah, Jesus, no wonder. Look, here's $10. Go get yourself something to eat. The patient came in saying one thing, and it was true. But that wasn't really the root cause. And so that's what you have to do with your users. And then you have to do sketches, wireframes, mock-ups with them before you start writing code. Because a lot of times the users will tell you things here. It's very, very easy to change now. It's easy and cheap to change now. Once you get it coded to write code, to write a program that runs this thing, it takes longer and costs more money. And you write something and you code it up and you show it to the user and they say, oh, damn, I hate it. Well, now what? You've got to either throw away the code that you've just so expensively written, or you've got to go shove that thing that they hate down the user's throats, and neither one of them is going to make you very profitable. But if you make changes early in the process, it's a lot simpler and a lot easier to change when they're still in the form of sketches. I'll give you an example. I've got a book actually called The Joy of UX, published in 2016. Any resemblance to The Joy of Cooking, The Joy of Sex is one hell of a coincidence now, ain't it? But anyway, I have a chapter in there that shows an app that I wrote for the MBTA's commuter rail system. The MBTA is the guys that run the public transportation here in Boston. Their commuter rail has an app. It's absolutely terrible. If you want to find the schedule of your train, it's terrible. You have to drill down through screens. You got to pick your station out of a big complicated list. It sucks. Whereas what I did is I said, okay, well here, you only care about your station, don't you? You shouldn't have to look at anything else. So just type in the station that you want. I'll remember it. And then I'll just always show you the list of trains to and from your station. Piece of cake. And I was showing that to a number of different users. And I had down at the bottom a countdown timer, a relatively small type, that next train shows up in 12 minutes. And the MBTA has a public data feed. You can get this information from them. So that's good. I salute them for doing that. And I had a little countdown timer and said, train coming in 12 minutes. And the user looked at it and said, oh, you know what? That countdown timer. I need it right up here at the top so I know if I need to run to make my train. And I thought, ah, of course. Call that a double hitter. Answer yourself on the end and say, holy Toledo. I never for a microsecond imagine whatever the hell. And then within 30 seconds, you again say, holy Toledo, what on God's good earth could be more obvious than this same whatever the hell? And once she saw that and reminded her, she said, ah, I need that on top. What could be more obvious? And especially because these commuter rails don't come very often. It's not like subways where they come along every 2 or 3 minutes. These are longer distance commuter rail. They leave about every half an hour during rush hour and much less often 2 hours or sometimes even 4 on weekends. So you really don't want to miss one if you don't have to. And that was the kind of thing. Just being able to show that in a sketch that would trigger this thought in her.
You gave me a good piece of advice. I asked you, what's the right level of fidelity for a mock-up? Because it's tempting, especially if you have some nice graphic designers, to make it look good.
No, do not make it look good. Make it look bad. The level of fidelity for a mock-up is the absolute least you can possibly get away with. You want to convey the essence of what you're doing and not have any details at all. For example, it's important to keep them monochrome. If you have something there that's blue and users are going to look at that and they're going to see the color and they're going to react to the color right away. Oh, that blue, yeah, could that be a little more green? You know, and that is not what you're doing at this stage of the game. If you show them decorations, it will be only distracting. What you're looking at is the lowest, most fundamental portion of the lowest, most fundamental expression of what you're trying to do. Partly because it's faster and cheaper to do it that way, so you can iterate more quickly, number one. But more to the point, you have to get the foundational building blocks first. Yes, I want to see the schedule. Yes, I need to see the arrival and the departure times of trains so I know which one to pick. Do I want them in ascending order or descending order? That sort of thing. You need to find that out, and you will find that out very quickly with the lowest possible fidelity that will convey the meaning that you want the user to choose from. And there's a program called Balsam IQ, that I like for that stretch. It's not only cheap and quick and disposable, but it appears cheap and quick and disposable. The fonts that the user labels are intentionally rickety, so they sort of look hand-sketched, to encourage users to say, yes, I like this, but I don't like that. Because if you show the user something polished, they will react to the polish and say, oh yeah, that's nice, that's polished in there, isn't it? Whatever thing you decide will be polished, and the problem is, when it does get polished, and it will, is it going to work right or not? Are they going to use it? Are the right pieces of information going to be in the right places? Are they going to be able to just look at it instantly and know exactly what piece, where, represents which thing? Or are they going to have to jump around to 5 different screens? And, you know, you put lipstick on a pig, and it's still a pig, all right? So start with the lowest fidelity you possibly can, number one, not to distract the users, and number two, to iterate smaller, faster, cheaper.
Now, you mentioned 2 of the books you've written, but I believe you've written many more than that.
I've written many more books on programming. If you remember COM, Olé, ActiveX, I wrote 3 books on that. Microsoft's new COM Plus, which was the fusion of COM and MTS, Microsoft Transaction Server, I wrote Microsoft Press's first book on that. I wrote Microsoft's first book on .NET. If you look at Introducing Microsoft.NET, the one with the anvil on the cover, I wrote that back in 2002, 2003. I did another edition in 2005. So I used to write programming books for serious geeks. And since then, I've sort of gotten into the user experience thing. And I've written 2 books on that. One was entitled Why Software Sucks. And I wrote that in 2007. And the idea was that I was going to show the community just what exactly was wrong with these things, and I would show them and they would stop doing it. I say, hey, look, you did this, it's dumb, don't do this. And they would say, thank you. Thank you so much for telling me. Oh, geez, I didn't realize. I thought it was good, but now that you told me it's bad, I see it's bad. Oh, yeah, okay, thank you. I've seen the error of my ways. I will stop. I will go. I will sin no more. Long story short, it didn't happen. If you go look at the Amazon, very proud of this, actually. If you go look at the reviews on Amazon, you will find that approximately 2/3 of them are 5-star reviews, and the remaining third are 1-star reviews. It's a book that you love or you hate, and with almost nothing in the middle. Almost nobody reads this book and says, yeah, suppose it was okay, I can take it or leave it. They all say, hey, that's fabulous, or no, that sucks, and you ought to be shot. And a lot of guys say, hey, you know, it's about time somebody called us out on this. And a few others say, well, no, they're furious that I've ripped the lid off their cozy sausage factory. Anyway, it didn't happen. I got a few disciples from that, but most guys said, yeah, okay, interesting ideas, but hey, we got a schedule to hit. And then I thought about it for a while, and I said, you know, it's not that they don't know what to do. I mean, I told them what to do and what not to do, but they don't know how to do it yet. And so that's why I wrote The Joy of UX. It's just my set of steps, the Plotsky protocol, if you will, of how to go about designing a user experience. You start with who. Who are your users? For my MBTA commuter rail application, I went to the MBTA and I went to the guys who sell their advertising and I asked for their press kit and I found out just they had all kinds of information about the demographics of their ridership because those are the guys that sell the advertising. So I knew that they were just about evenly split male and female, you know, 48-52, well within the margin of error. But if you go look at their age brackets, the largest single cohort was 45 to 55 years old is who's riding the commuter rail. Gen Zs are not riding commuter rails. They graduate from college, they work downtown, they meet, they get married, they stay downtown, they have the first kid downtown, and then when they have the second kid, they don't fit in the apartment anymore, they need to move out, get some more elbow room, place for a yard with a swing set and a golden retriever, and start riding the commuter rail, or at least they did until COVID. Anyway, so that is the largest cohort that you find. And in fact, more than the median point of the ridership is about 48 years old. So they tend to skew older. And so, you know, aren't going to be amazed by the flash kinds of things that the younger generation would want. So who are the users and how do you find them out? Then what problems are the user trying to solve and expressing them through stories? Try to explain to the programmer geeks through writing narrative stories. Our user is named Claire. She lives in Salem. She wakes up in the morning and she looks out and she says, oh, damn, it snowed again. Geez, is my train still running? She picks up her phone, taps up her app. There's the train. Oh, damn, her regular train's canceled. But oh, wait a minute. There's another one that she can make if she hustles, et cetera, et cetera. And then you do some mock-ups and then you try the mock-ups on some users, as I was talking about. You wire the app for telemetry so you can see what the users are doing and so on. And the final simplification. So many programmer geeks, the night before they ship, they're trying to cram in one more feature. Whereas Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, a famous French aviator, used to say, true perfection occurs not when there is no more to add, but rather when there is no more to remove. And so the last thing you should be doing the night before you ship is to say, okay, how can we make it even easier for the user? No matter what we do, how can you make it even easier?
So one company that has become famous for making it easy and has garnered a lot of attention for their user interface and user experience is Apple. They've become very successful because of it. Are there any positives or negatives that you have seen from observing their products and software?
Well, you know, Apple gets some things very, very, very right and other things completely and totally wrong. Here, this is my Apple iPad Mini. I love this thing. I am addicted to this thing. If I could have it surgically implanted, I'd give it some thought. I use this for browsing my email, but more to the point, I borrow library books on it. And it's smaller and lighter than a library book. It fits in the pocket of my regular pants. I absolutely love this. Apple did a lot of things in the early days. Yes, they came out with a graphical user interface where people with DOS were still typing in commands. And yes, that was revolutionary. And hey, they are the most valuable company that's ever been seen on the face of the planet. You know, they're definitely doing something right. At the same time, when I started looking at the senior thing, there's some things that they get extremely wrong to the point where I want to punch someone in the nose. And I'm not a warlike guy, but for example, here again on this iPad Mini, if you look here, you guys out in radio and can't really see it, but this is my iPad Mini. Now on Apple, you can set large icons or small, and I set these large, and the large icons are 4 across and 6 down, right? So that's what they are. If they were small, they would be 5 across, and I think they're 8 down, or maybe even 6 across. But these are the largest icons I can have. Now for my dad, these are too small. He really can't see, he has trouble picking out the picture, and the text below them is just way, way, way too small. Now, Apple does not have an extra large setting. And so by doing that, Apple is saying, hey, you know what? We really don't care about anybody over 70. That may not be what goes through their heads, but that is the end result of this choice. Now, you say that to Apple and say, oh, no, no, no. Well, we have a magnifier mode. If you need something bigger, a magnifier mode. Well, you know what the magnifier mode is? You tap it, you set it, and what you can now do is you can use 3 fingers on the display, and you can spread things apart. And you can zoom in on any part of the screen, and you can zoom around and drag and drop, stuff like that. For Somebody who is 25 years old and has full dexterity of their fingertips and full cognitive resources to understand what's happening, but just is legally blind, can't see very well. That's fabulous. That's great. And a guy like that in a class that I taught once, and that would have been an absolutely fabulous thing for him. My father can't begin to touch that. Using three fingers for a spread gesture? Oh, please. I'm enough of a programmer to know, look, guys, it wouldn't be real hard instead of four across and six down to have another mode that would be three across and about four down, and my dad could actually read that.
And bump the font, too. Like the font for the little icons, it's hard to read.
It very much is, and maybe there's a way of increasing it, but I haven't found the damn thing. And if it does exist, well, it's hidden past where I can see it. It needs to be made more visible. So some things that they did very well, I mean, the notion of a GUI, graphical user interface, versus a command line screen was cataclysmic. And this is just so much more aesthetically pleasing. I've got an Amazon Fire, a Kindle Fire that I got earlier, and it's got roughly the same capability, but it's thicker, it's clunkier, it's heavier. Bothers me intensely how much more attractive I find this smooth, slender, lighter case. It's true. Bothers me, but it's true. But at the same time, they could do so much better, and especially for the senior market that I've gotten interested in, and they're really not trying. I think if it got through their heads, you know what? Hey, 70-year-olds can't do this very well, and just an extra large icon mode, they can knock it out like that. It's just not occurring to them that, hey, the senior market is different and they should be doing something.
So, folks, if you do know a way to get that extra large icon mode, you can let us know at underserved@syrinx.com. That's underserved@syrinx.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, all of this season, as well as our previous two seasons, are available on our website. That is underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio. And folks, if you want to get in touch with Dave, you can reach him at the website he mentioned before, which is assistedcomputing.org. And there's a form on there you can fill out to get in touch with him. So Dave, I understand you also do some mentoring of a high school robotics team.
I do. Here in Ipswich High School, there's this league called the First Robotics League. It was founded by Dean Kamen, the inventor of the Segway scooter and some of the early insulin pumps that worked too. And with his fortune, he's starting these robotics competitions to interest high school students and earlier in science and technology and working on projects like that. There's even First Lego League for elementary school students. I don't work in that one. But my daughter, Annabelle, got interested in eighth grade, the robotics team that started up at the school. And they need mentors to help guide the students. And like an idiot, I signed up to mentor their software group. And I find it fascinating. You know, these young geeks, their brains are so malleable. And I started when my daughter was in ninth grade, I guess, and I kept on going until she was a senior, and then the next year, and even this year, we started spinning up the software group now for this year. And there are two. There's a lady who's in 10th grade. There's a guy who's in ninth grade. And they're smart. And I'm trying to guide them the amount that is the right amount in the directions that are the right directions. I rack my brains constantly just how exactly to do that. Right now we're talking about, because it's very hard to meet in person because of COVID, hey, could we drive these robots on a virtual screen? There actually is a product that does that. Synthesis is made by Autodesk, and we could build virtual robots on that and drive them around. Been trying to work on their simulation software, and of course it doesn't work quite right, and then we have to get into the open source code. And just last year we were adding vision to our robot. We were using those little pixie cams that you can buy for $65, and it's fascinating, the energy, drive, the verve, the things that are possible when you haven't yet learned what's impossible.
They haven't become the grizzled old cynical developers yet?
Yes, trying to give them the dose of that is the right dose. And yet the naivete, the chasing down blind alleys, the failure to understand users aren't like you, that users don't do what you wish they would, even though you wish they would. They don't do what they say they will, even though they promise you that they will. And stuff like that. And you think that this is going to get done in time, and it never does get done in time. And the constant time creep that just gnaws away at things.
And feature creep.
Yes. And to try to build the good stuff without squashing it is a constant balancing act. And I scratch my head constantly. What exactly is the right level there?
All right, folks, thank you very much for joining us. And Dave, thank you very much for sharing some great knowledge.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. Always good to be back with my friends at Syrinx again.
And we'll talk to you all soon on the next episode of Underserved.